The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Howdy, this is Rand Fishkin, author of Lost and Founder, a painfully honest field guide to the startup world. And you are listening to Authors in Quarantine Getting Cocktails.
Hello and welcome to this hopefully short-lived series that will be airing in addition to the weekly Marketing Book podcast interviews. I'm your host, Douglas Burdett, and my goal during this unusual time is to reconnect you with past guests on the Marketing Book podcast, share some ideas and inspiration, and maybe a much-needed laugh or two. I've interviewed over 200 authors on the show, and my plan is to continue this series until I either run out of authors or quarantine, whichever comes first. A word of warning, the host and guest may very likely be drinking cocktails during these conversations. I mean, come on. They are recorded during the cocktail hour. To find the show notes for each episode with pictures of each guest and links mentioned in their conversation, visit marketingbookcocktails.com. Marketingbookcocktails.com. See what I did there? And if you'd like to join the conversation, email a voice recording to me at douglas@salesartillery.com, and I'll try to include it in a future episode. I'd love to hear from you. Otherwise, connect with me on LinkedIn where we can chat. So, Rand Fishkin, welcome to Authors in Quarantine Getting Cocktails. How are you?
I'm doing okay. How about yourself, Douglas?
Well, I'm doing well. I've got a glass of Balvenie, a single malt scotch, and I heard you mixing up a drink there. What is it you have?
This is a John Cameron, named for the film director, and created by a friend of mine, Andrew Borer, here in Seattle, who's a mixologist, famous for doing the cocktail programs at a few different local bars, and sent me this recipe, which is vermouth de Torino, orange bitters, and a little bit of Ardbeg.
Oh, wow. Well, if it's possible to get that, I'll include the recipe on this your show notes here. So
yeah, sure, I'll send.
Great. So now you're in Seattle you're sheltering in place, I suppose. And when I interviewed you about your book, Lost and Founder, A Painfully Honest Guide to the Startup World, and boy, if there were ever a book title that were on it that was honest, that's it. You talk in the book about your grandparents, and I even included a picture of them in the show notes for that episode. I guess I was wondering also, how are they doing?
Yeah, amazingly, at 93 and 94, they are still around. They just moved from New Jersey to Seattle to a retirement community here, and yeah, they're doing okay. I mean, they're sort of locked in their room during this quarantine, you know, COVID scare. And Seattle, as you might recall, had that outbreak at a retirement community that was particularly deadly. So yeah, they're taking a lot of precautions, but, I go over there every week or so, stand outside their window and give them a phone call.
Oh, that's great. That's great. I know they must appreciate it, and it's really difficult not being able to do that, but you know, I guess that's what we got to do right now. Now, for folks that may not be familiar with you, you are the co-founder of Moz, which is one of the mm-hmm. top search engine optimization software tools, and you have since left there. And being the good serial entrepreneur, you're the founder of SparkToro. And wanted to ask you a little bit about SparkToro, but before we get to that, Rand, you have been very generous and thoughtful, particularly with two blog posts that are on the SparkToro website that I'll make sure to link to so that folks can learn more about that. And on March 17th, you wrote a post about extraordinary times call for extraordinary measures. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about what big tech might be doing to help folks who, one could argue, need the most help right now.
Yeah. Well, so, I mean, my sense is that in a world where human-to-human contact is dangerous, which we're living in and probably will live in for, you know, the next 12 to 18 months while a vaccine is being developed, the tech world has a unique opportunity to help people in all sorts of ways. And that's everything from digital products to video connections and audio chats like the one that we're having, to content, you know, everything from Netflix to Disney Plus to Google Play, to e-commerce, right? Getting your products delivered. And I think that big tech has less exposure to the economic recession and to the challenges posed by that than most small businesses. You know, the travel and hospitality industries are especially hard hit, but big tech is one of the few places where I think money is going to keep flowing. And so I think anytime you are in a position of privilege when others are suffering, you have an obligation to help. And so my hope in writing that post was to nudge some of the big tech companies into taking some actions that could be helpful to entrepreneurs and small businesses and consumers and those who are afflicted. And I'm, you know, I'm pleased to see that some of those companies have been responding in some of those ways. Google, just about, I think it was 10 days ago now, did almost exactly one of the things that I recommended. I'm sure it was on their radar long before, you know, I blogged about it, but they essentially released ad credits for small businesses to be able to use for free, much in the same way that they do for nonprofits and charities. I think that's a great opportunity. I wish they'd expand the program a little bit, but nice to see.
Yeah, and you had also suggested that they need to overhaul their local listings as soon as possible. Talk about that.
Yeah, so I'm not sure how many folks are familiar with exactly how Google's local listing system works, but you know, when you search for a business, historically you would get Google would often rank that business's website, which meant that the business could sort of, you know, update and change everything about whatever they needed to present to visitors whenever they wanted. That changed a few years ago as Google started prioritizing placing their own Google Maps listings ahead of anything else. And I think that's, you know, that's Google sort of exerting their monopoly power to be able to make themselves the leader in rankings, local, you know, ratings and reviews and local information, all that kind of stuff, and you know, outcompete TripAdvisor and Yelp and those folks. But the frustrating part for many small business owners, of course, was when this crisis hit and they wanted to shift from, you know, whatever it was, a restaurant business, they wanted to shift from dine-in to takeout and delivery. Mm-hmm. A hair salon that wanted to offer video consultations for, you know, your partner to cut your hair at home. A yoga studio that wanted to start offering online classes. And navigating the spectrum of, you know, what Google Local and Google Maps would and wouldn't allow, and how to make those changes, and how to get people from Google's interface to over to your website, that stuff has been pretty thorny and frustrating. Google has made some efforts in that area. I think folks who work on Google Maps would agree it's not yet nearly enough, but I hope to keep encouraging them to make those changes.
Mm. So the first recommendation you had in there, which is interesting, and it's not about Google, it was about allowing links on Instagram. Can you explain what you had in mind there?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think most folks are familiar with the fact that a Facebook post, a Twitter post, a LinkedIn post, a Reddit post, right? You can include a link to another place on the internet. Instagram is one of the few platforms, TikTok and a few others, don't allow links. So, you know, if I post a photo and I say, hey, I did this great yoga class online, here's where you can do it yourself, right? You can't go to that URL. You can't click that link. It doesn't become a link. Some people get around this by changing the link in their profile when they update their, when they put up a post and linking directly to something. And that's a frustrating and low quality workaround. But I think now is a time when Instagram might test that type of functionality, right? Very, very, very easy to make work, right? To make links live and send people over. Instagram, in fact, already allows it if you pay Instagram with an ad. So when you get an Instagram ad, of course, those have a link and Instagram's happy to send traffic somewhere so long as you pay them. I think now would be a great time for Instagram to help out tens of millions of people by allowing them to support and share links to the small businesses and pages that they want to support. I honestly don't think it would cost them much of anything, except maybe a little bit of time on site. And I think the benefits would be massive to a ton of folks.
Yeah, it would be very interesting. What are some of the things that you're seeing people do, you know, as individuals that are helping businesses? I mean, what can a person be doing these days that would have the biggest impact on some of these businesses that are getting hit so hard? I'm thinking local businesses particularly.
Yeah. This is a very tough thing to say, right? And I think it's probably controversial, but most likely the best thing that you can possibly do for local businesses and for your ecosystem is to vote well and vote wisely in your elections. And that is because this crisis, I think, has peeled back the skin, the outer layer of the economic and political system that we have, and revealed that we are all in this together. And there is no amount of donating or funding or buying things online or ordering food delivery that is going to make a small business survive this level of crisis, right? The only thing that's going to do it is government intervention and lots of support and help from your federal authorities, your state authorities, wherever you live. And you mm-hmm. can see that, in certain places that's been going really, really well. The a few advanced economies in places like Denmark and Canada and Norway, the Czech Republic, France and Germany. Germany's surviving this shockingly well. True in places like South Korea and Taiwan and Singapore, and the United States, I think, could be a great example as well. But I think we obviously have the resources, we have the people, we have, had an incredible economy mm-hmm. as of even just a few weeks ago. And we've got the wealth to do this, but I think we need, we're going to need the support of leadership, capable, competent people who care at the top and throughout our bureaucratic systems. And that is probably the best, most impactful thing that you can do as a person. Doesn't feel like it. I don't think voting feels to many Americans like it's this huge thing that I'm doing to help my local economy, but it is. Absolutely is.
Yeah. And I hear enough stories about close elections that, I'm compelled to go vote and, it actually makes me feel better. So there's a psychic reward as well. I think that if Hollywood scriptwriter had come up with this idea of this pandemic that we're living through just before in the case of the United States, a presidential and a congressional, federal elections, many state elections, I think folks would have said, come on, that's just too much. That's too fantastical.
And I mean, I think you'd get a lot of folks saying, and this has been true throughout this sort of presidency, right? That there's a lot of things that feel farcical and way too far-fetched to be realistic in a story, right? Well, right, no one is that bombastic, no one is that confrontational, no one is that directly opposed to facts, right? And surely no Congress would actually support that behavior. I mean, Republicans especially, they hate that kind of thing. There's no way a Republican-controlled Congress would allow, you know, and then list of X and Y and Z things that have happened. But yeah, I think we've learned a lot about, you know, how our democracy functions and doesn't these last few years. And I think it's foolhardy to think that this is purely a, you know, federal leadership at the executive branch level problem. I think there's challenges throughout our political system. And voting is a weirdly powerful way to change that.
Yes. And I'm thinking that this has really got people paying attention to how a lot of these things work. And I'm hearing a lot of discussion on the, I kind of stopped watching the news, but I've heard on some, just because of my own mental health.
Yes, wise.
Turn it off. But, you know, I still can read some articles online and listen to a podcast and there. And there's all this, what I think is refreshing talk, regardless of what the topic is, about, well, wait a minute, the federal government's not allowed to do that, or that's what the state is supposed to do. Or, you know, they talk about the power of the states, and I'm just thinking, well, this is all kind of, I'm glad all these discussions are going on right now. So, that's a great answer about voting. And aren't we fortunate that we can have a choice?
Yeah.
And
I think, I think a fair thing to say. I think a lot of people would say, "Gosh, voting feels like a very small act." Is there something else that I can do? And I think change the minds of other people around you, right? Mm-hmm. Your friends and family and neighbors who might not be voting, or who might be voting for whatever candidates or parties or initiatives, right? Ballot initiatives that you think are antithetical to supporting and helping your local ecosystem. And I think one great thing is that many, many areas have had small business conglomerates come together. The Seattle area where I live has had a bunch of local small businesses band together under this sort of umbrella, supported and amplified by the Pike Place Market Foundation. Pike Place Market being a sort of famous tourist destination, but it's also a functioning public market. That supports, I think, thousands of vendors, unique vendors, down in downtown Seattle. And they've all sort of come together and have a weekly newsletter that they send out around things that, you know, they're looking for from city officials, state officials, federal officials, you know, policies that potentially are interesting and that could help them a lot. And that's been really cool to see.
Absolutely. So, let's go to, I just can't resist, these two posts you did. There was another one that came out about a week later, and it was called "Marketing Right Now is Frigging Hard." Now, frigging was not in the headline. It was #%% star ing hard. And really struck a nerve with me. And I just think that, you know, if you could talk to the Marketing Book podcast listeners, because they're all wondering not only just what to do now, but how does this change things? How does this affect this crazy thing we call marketing?
Yeah. So I think I wrote that post during what I think was the height of fear and uncertainty surrounding both the virus's impact and the American response to it. And, you know, we are having this conversation in early to mid-April, and many more things are known. I think that we are in a period where we can start to look toward the future. There's still a lot of scariness and uncertainty ahead, but much more of that is economic uncertainty versus viral uncertainty, where I think the models are getting better and better day by day. We understand what hospital capacities will and won't look like and where they're going to be hard hit and all those kinds of things. But at the time that I wrote that post, you know, it was basically taking stock of the uncertainty of the environment and recognizing that for many people, the way to do marketing at that time was probably not to sell and promote, but rather to help and support. And I think that, you know, for folks who wondered, should I be doing any marketing at all? I think the answer is yes. It just had to be audited and changed to focus on how you could help other people.
Right. Focusing on, are we helping?
Yeah, yeah. Are we helping in big or small ways, right? I don't think that it is restricted to, well, look, if you're not getting, you know, personal protective equipment to healthcare providers, you should shut the hell up. That's not true, right? If you are taking your Broadway show and doing it online and all your actors are, you know, doing remote bits from their houses, awesome. That is helping people, right? That's providing desperately needed entertainment and a little breathing room, and also potentially building future demand for your show, because gosh, we desperately are going to need to, you know, get actors and theaters back to work when we can. Mm-hmm. I hope we're all going to go out and support the arts, which are often the hardest and worst hit in economic recessions.
Yeah. And actually, as a matter of fact, the other day I was interviewing Paul Smith, author of several books about storytelling, Sell with a Story, The 10 Stories Great Leaders Tell. And he said the thing that he misses the most is live music.
Yeah.
And so he was going to hire a live musician and do like a concert for all of his friends. So yeah, it's true. I think more than ever, people are going to want to go to live events. They're going to want to go to, you know, conferences. I mean, it's pretty hard to keep humans away from other humans, but yeah, I agree.
So, well, it's going to be, yeah, I think it's an interesting, unknown right now is, will it be the case that, let's say 7 or 8 months from now, when we have maybe more robust testing and lower infection rates, more hospital capacity, plenty of ventilators, all that kind of stuff, are people still going to be scared to go outside and interact with each other because the virus still exists and there's still risk and there's not yet a vaccine? Or is it going to be return to normalcy with sort of a deadlier version of the flu out there and some, you know, and a lot more testing and sort of local quarantines and lockdowns in various areas. And I don't know. I don't know what the answer to that is. So it could be, I think it could be an extended period before conferences and events are popular again.
Yeah. You had in that article an example, and a rather unfortunate example from, I think it was BMW.
Where
I think I've got it here in front of me. It says, shows a picture of a gorgeous car, and it says, be a roadblock of the outbreak and make your own contribution to hashtag flatten the curve. The BMW i8 Coupe Ultimate Sophisto Edition. really, you know, flat footed. And I kind of thought of BMW as maybe being a little more, adept than that. But then you've also gone on, and hopefully, I don't know, hopefully they've taken that down wherever that was, and they've done other good things. But then you talk about an example of a kettle and fire where they say, stock up. They show their products, stock up so you're prepared at home. See, that's, in case anyone didn't catch that, they're being helpful.
Right. I mean, it's not all that much different, right? Both companies are selling their product. It's just a recognition of the environment that they're in and how they're positioning it. I think those are really different things. I gave the example in a later post about McDonald's versus Burger King. You know, McDonald's did a sort of odd, awkward promotion. It wasn't in bad taste. It was just strange, where they separated the golden arches. So one half of the M was apart from the other half of the M. And they were like, oh, look at our arches, our social distancing.
Uh-huh.
Which seemed very strange to me, right? It's sort of a, okay. No, and? I don't think physical signage. Yeah, exactly. And so what? Right? As opposed to Burger King, which did two things that I thought were quite creative. One was they took their signage on their restaurants, which says home of the Whopper, and crossed out of the Whopper and put a little stay in front of home.
Yeah.
Right. So instead of home of the Whopper, it's stay home, which is the right message to be sending. And secondarily, they released a bunch of viral visual ads that focused on how to make your own Whopper at home. And they're not using, you know, ingredients that the Burger King parent company profits off of. It's just a, hey, are you feeling like, gosh, I wish I could have a Whopper burger at my house? We're just helping people get through this and you know, have a little bit of fun. And
I think
that's a good approach.
My gym is closed and I can't go to it. And March 18th, the day after you wrote that first post, I think I had the last elective surgery. It was to fix a rotator cuff, a rotator cuff repair, and it went extremely well. So I can't run, I can't ride a bike, but all I can do is walk. So I go for these long walks, and people are all waving to each other. They all want to say hello. There's a lot of people that want to talk, people I don't know. And I think that brings to mind what Burger King was doing, which is that they're just saying, hi, how you doing?
Yeah.
Hang in there. Yeah. Similar sort of thing. So, Ran, a lot of people probably know you from those Whiteboard Friday videos you did, which, at least for us, it was kind of a Friday luncheon thing where we could have lunch and see what Ran's got for us, and you could explain the intricacies or the basics of search engine optimization like no one else. And I was wondering if you could tell folks, because you've left Moz, but you're still a partial owner, I believe. You're on the board. Explain what Moz is, but also talk about what your new venture is and what that does and what some of those tools are.
Sure, yeah. So Moz, my first company, was made software for search engine optimization professionals. So folks who are trying to help people and businesses earn organic, non-paid traffic from the search engines, primarily Google these days. That company is still going and still offering their products, still pretty popular.
Mm-hmm. And there's a free tool that people can put on their Chrome browser.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, the Moz Bar.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That was one of the projects I worked on, sort of designed early on, a few different iterations of. I really actually enjoyed that. I wish we'd invested more in that. I think there could have been great business even just with that thing. Mm-hmm. But yes, so my new company, which I started a couple of years ago, raised some money for it in June of 2018, and basically built the product, ran a beta last summer and through to the fall, and then did a little bit of work sort of redesigning and rebuilding the app, and now have been in early access for some folks on our wait list for a couple months, and we're actually going to be launching possibly next week, as early as next week.
Oh, excellent. Well, I signed up for it a long time ago, so move me up at the line there, Mr. Fishkin.
No, you probably, in fact, you almost certainly have already received an invite. You might want to check your spam.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think I use the email that I use for my newsletter, so definitely comb through there. But talk about what the product does.
Sure. Yeah. So SparkToro is designed to help marketers and entrepreneurs and product folks, PRs, discover the sources of influence for any audience. So if you are curious what chemical engineers in Canada read, watch, and listen to, what they follow, what they pay attention to, SparkToro can tell you, instead of running a $50,000 market research study or a large-scale survey, we can tell you based on the data that is public on the web from tens of millions of social profiles and web profiles. We crawl and index those and then allow it to be searchable by anyone. So you can figure out what exactly your audience, which podcasts they listen to, what YouTube channels they subscribe to, who and what they follow on social media, what they share and read on the web from different publications.
What they're wearing right now?
No. although we could tell you words and phrases that they commonly use. So if you have an audience that is likely to talk about which fashion brands they're expressing interest in, yes, we could tell you that potentially.
Okay. Oh, well, yeah. I'm all over that. Yeah, and actually, you can sign up for early access there, and you've got a video that explains it in 2 minutes. But I don't know. I think a lot of Marketing Book podcast listeners might have some time to check that out and see if they might be able to, you know.
Sure.
Might work for them. So at any rate, well, Ran, I really appreciate you making some time to have cocktails with myself and the Marketing Book podcast listeners.
My pleasure.
And please don't stop writing the blog posts. And do you think that there will be any more books in your future?
Let's see. I think if SparkToro goes well and I have some lessons to share and take away from that in, you know, 3 to 5 years, yeah, that wouldn't surprise me. My goal is not to write a book to write a book, but rather to write a book to, you know, to truly help people and to share experiences that I've learned, that we've learned, that hopefully can be of great value to other people.
Well, I hope you don't feel pressure to write another book. And here's why I say that. Your book, Lost and Founder, it just you were so honest about what you got right, what you got wrong, what you learned. I mean, you really are, it was full of transparency and honesty and you know, realizing what maybe some of your strengths and weaknesses are. And it's just, that's in such short supply. I don't think I could ever write a follow-up to that.
Well, I mean, my hope is that SparkToro is a company. It's a very unique company, both in its structure and in the way that it serves customers. And so I'm hoping that I can sort of compare and contrast these two businesses in a way that is really useful to folks, right? I think that there's a lot of entrepreneurs who think about, hey, maybe I'd like to create a software business, or I want to do something in SaaS, but I want it to be more of a personal project than a, you know, venture-backed, sort of built to become a billion-dollar company model. And I don't think there's enough resources around that. I think, unfortunately, especially in the tech ecosystem, everything is focused on how to build something at venture scale and learning from the great entrepreneurs who, you know, are made billion-dollar companies and
the unicorns.
Yeah, and I honestly don't think that model is right for most people. I don't think most people should try to do it. I don't think the learnings are as applicable as people think they are. I think what you can learn from, you know, a two-person company that's been going for 7 years profitably is probably much greater than what you can learn from Google or Facebook or Amazon.
But that doesn't make for a sexy article in the tech news media.
I disagree. I think it makes for a very sexy article. I think it's just not one that the moneyed interests wish to amplify.
Okay.
I think there's an incentive model problem, but yes, yeah.
Yeah, well, you talked about, well, for instance, so many things, but one of them was this mythology of the, I mean, picture Mark Zuckerberg with some sort of weird Julius Caesar haircut. He's there in the t-shirt and the hoodie, and, you know, he's young and he started this. And you explained how that's not really, he was the exception to the normal profile. Most of these startup founders were, I think you said, in their 40s, and they were from rather well-heeled backgrounds.
Oh, and I mean, Mark Zuckerberg's parents were millionaires, right? Oh, he went to Harvard. He didn't get a scholarship. I mean, you know, he could have dropped out and done nothing with his life and been more comfortable than 99% of the population. Mm. So I think, there's a lot of mythology. There's a lot of false narratives embedded in startup tech culture, and Lost and Founder obviously is designed to dismantle a bunch of those. But my hope is that in the future, I will not dismantle some myths, but also build some new infrastructure and build some new pathways, you know, a roadmap for people to be able to follow, to build their own small but profitable, long-term successful businesses.
Yes, and you described in Lost and Founder as it was great big cheat code where people can you know, not have such so many of the problems that you learned the hard way. So I thought that was very generous. Just curious, did you get much blowback from the tech media about your book?
Let's see. I would not say much blowback. I would say instead, I got people saying, what are you doing? You'll never be able to get funded, right? No venture firm will ever want to work with you. And my response was, I think you've misunderstood my position. I also do not wish to work with them.
Right. I remember that.
Right. Ooh. This is a knowing declaration that I'm making here.
Isn't it great when you get criticism from people who haven't read your book?
I don't mind that too much, right? I think that's fine. Yeah, one of my favorite pieces of criticism was someone who is a huge Scott Adams fan. Mm-hmm. The cartoonist.
Well, that's right. You didn't hold back on Scott Adams in your book, as I recall. You made some comment.
Yeah. I think in the postscript, but sort of
there was a footnote in one, or something, an asterisk.
Yeah, in one footnote, in one asterisk, I think I called him a shitburger of a person, and I kind of stand by that, right? I think he's proven himself to be misogynistic and tone deaf and sort of a weird amplifier of cult of personality. But regardless, many of the negative reviews that I have on whatever Amazon and sites like that are from people who are big Scott Adams fans.
Really?
I think that was it was sort of funny to realize, like, well, you know, the VCs might have been like, oh, it's fine. You know, Rand doesn't think that model's right for him, and he's pretty even handed about, you know, who it is right for, who it's not right for. That's fine. But it was the Scott Adams fans who really got upset about that one footnote.
Okay. Yeah. Cause I remember seeing that. I didn't really know as much about Scott Adams. And then I later got to interview him for the Marketing Book Podcast.
Oh, about interesting. Yeah.
His last book, Loser Think, which probably means that Rand Fishkin will never come back in the Marketing Book Podcast, but I'm trying to cover the waterfront there.
No, I'm curious. What did you think of the book? What did you think of him?
I thought it was an interesting book. He explained, I think there was one before that, I think called Win Bigly, which was more about...
Win Bigly, right.
And I didn't read it, okay? Full disclosure. I didn't read Win Bigly, and it was about what President Trump was doing to persuade people, or the ways, the techniques he was using, I gather. I'm not sure. I heard from another author who said it wasn't very ethical because it was encouraging people to do those things. I don't know. I'll shut up now because I haven't read the book. But Loser Think, I don't remember that as being a whole lot about politics, although he would occasionally point to political discussions. It was more about the mental models that different people have, like the way a lawyer thinks, the way an engineer thinks, the way a scientist thinks, the way... It was all these different ways, and I'm sure, you know, everyone interprets it differently, but what it did for me was I think it made me a little more empathetic as to why people hold the beliefs that they do, or why they approach ideas and problem solving in different ways.
Yeah, interesting. Okay.
So cool. I don't know that you're going to spend much time reading it, but... I remember hearing, about Win Bigly, but I didn't, I didn't read that, but Loser Think for me, I'm looking at it through sort of a marketing lens. And what resonated for me in the book was, you know, how a prospect will be, misinformed, or somebody says these people just don't understand what we're trying to explain them, or, you know, a salesperson might be thinking that. I think that for me was helpful because it's a way of saying, okay, well, wait a minute. It's not like they're dumb. It's not like they're wrong. There's a reason why they're thinking this way. So that was my takeaway, but I guess I don't have as much of a political, I don't see things through as much of a political lens. Don't know as much about that, but you know, speaking of politics, Rand Fishkin, you said that voting was very important, and I wanted to add one other thing. And you talked about changing minds, and there was a show recently on the Marketing Book Podcast with Jonah Berger, who's with the Wharton School. He wrote Contagious, and this book is called Catalyst, How to Change Anyone's Mind.
Yes, I saw some ads for it, yeah.
Yeah, and so that, I thought, was very interesting. And as we all move towards elections, wherever we happen to be living in the world, he even gave examples, and he was very, very balanced in the book, but he gave examples of how people have come to change their minds about politics or products or attitudes. Mm-hmm. And
yeah,
it's based on a lot of, you know, existing research as well as new research. And I thought, boy, that's an interesting one to have as you go towards an election. So I realize you're still busy, but that might be one that you would really enjoy. And he's got lots of examples.
I think one of the, you know, one of the things that's consistently frustrating me about politics in general, in the United States, especially more so than most places, because I think we sort of tie our cultural and human identities to a political party here more than in most places. And, you know, changing someone's mind, unfortunately, means you have to, in a lot of cases, rewrite their impression of who they are.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And change their mind about who they are as a person, what community they belong to, how they interact with their friends and family and loved ones. And that is massively harder than saying, well, you know, this political decision on how to handle whatever this phase of the epidemic and whether to, you know, make these orders about schools, blah, 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 seemed very unwise. I think maybe we should vote for someone else who's going to make better decisions in the future. And that just isn't the American way. You know, the American way is, look, I'm a proud X, and I will fight to the end for X, no matter what X represents,
right,
or which decisions political, you know, appointee of X makes. And that is, that's a really bad way to do politics, right?
Yeah.
It's very dangerous.
Jonah Berger's first two books were Contagious and Invisible Influence. And there are over a million copies of his first two books out. The Catalyst, and I'm no fortune teller or, you know, whatever, but I think that one's going to sell a million copies. It's that good. And as a matter of fact, speaking of politics, and some of my facts are a little murky now, but he talked about how there was a proposition in the state of California about gay marriage a while back, and I think it failed. It was voted down.
It did. Almost succeeded, but yes, it was a proposition, I believe, that was funded primarily by the Mormon Church. Remember the name, but yeah.
He then talked about how the people behind that proposition who had lost then started what they did. And what they started to do to try to better understand why people voted against the thing that they advocated for. And he has examples of people that actually came around after they started this conversation and basically more deeply understanding one another. So it was just, there were all kinds of examples of that, you know, and there were even examples of, you know, all the political divides. So I think that might be one that you would enjoy. So this concludes my recommendations for Rand Fishkin's reading list. But
it's been really, really interesting. So I looked up The Catalyst, and the reviews are fascinating, right? Because it is exactly the sort of review ratings you would expect from a very politically charged book. It's, you know, sort of 52% 5-star, and then a bunch of very low percentage reviews, and the low percentage reviews tend to be I don't like that Jonah Berger is supporting LGBTQ issues in his book, right? And so it's not a was the book well written, or were the points well made? It's just how dare he advocate for LGBTQ plus people? Which
I don't think he was advocating.
I don't know, right?
He was simply showing examples of how.
Well, so first off, let's both hope that he was advocating, because that is the only right thing to do.
Well, no, listen.
You cannot be a quality human being and not advocate for LGBTQ plus rights.
No, I'm not. Right? All the political things in his book, all those things. What I'm saying is he was pointing to all these different political things and saying, here's an example. In other words, he had one story about a liberal person who became increasingly conservative. But he was I don't think he was advocating or pushing away, you know, trying to downplay certain things. He was showing examples of people who had very differing points of view and how they came to better understand, or how they basically all sides, he came around and showed how they changed and how their minds were changed, which illuminated the points that he was talking about in the book.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. But so, yeah, the reviews, right, would seem to suggest.
Oh, yes, yes.
What many people's takeaway from the book was, you know, Jonah Berger is basically making the assumption that it is the right thing or the correct thing to do to support LGBTQ rights. Right. And from that presupposition, then discussing, you know, this these various political tacts and these arguments that people made and what were successful and not successful. And so, you know, yes, their core frustration stands out above the quality of the persuasiveness of the material.
Okay. Yeah. So it was like a dog whistle, or they were people. Well, first off, I just wondered, and I'll never know the answer, but how many of those folks actually read the book?
This is a very reasonable question. I believe Amazon does require you to purchase the book. It has to be in your purchase history in order for you to have written a review, but they could have gotten it, read one page, and then thrown it out.
Right. Yeah. So yeah. Well, anyway. Well, Rand, thank you very much. And thanks to Geraldine for allowing you to get out of the house for a few minutes to have a conversation with a knuckleheaded podcaster. And I'm going to send as many folks I can to Spark Toro and the blog post that you've written. And I hope that if there is a book in the future, or if there's something else I can do to help, you'll let me know.
Well, likewise, Douglas. I really appreciate you having me on. Take care.
All right, everybody. Last call.